As land values soared to record levels in the past year, how much did they increase percentage-wise in North Dakota?
Well, stay tuned to the latest Well-Grounded podcast and find out. This is Randy Conan from the Red River Farm Network.
And this is Jason Menke from Acres and Shares.
This podcast brings together experts from the world of agriculture and real estate. We'll talk about farmland values, industry trends, and the economy.
In this edition of Well-Grounded, our guest is Brian Parman. He is an agricultural finance specialist at North Dakota State Extension or University Extension. Parman has been at NDSU for the past 5 years. He was previously in a similar role at Mississippi State University and is originally from southwest Nebraska.
In his current role, Brian identifies financial issues faced by North Dakota farmers, livestock producers, and develops extension programs to help keep North Dakota agriculture financially healthy. Today, we'll talk to Brian about the 2023 North Dakota Department of Trust Land Survey released this spring and his role with the survey. Welcome back, Brian.
Hey, thanks for having me on again.
So Brian, historically, the study is released in March-April timeframe, so this is the third year we've had you on as a guest. Can you please share the background of the survey with our listeners?
Sure. So the North Dakota State Department of Trust Lands does a county rents and values survey for pasture land and cropland, and it's county-specific within the survey. And a lot of that's done for, you know, valuations for like CRP reimbursement and whatever, because you kind of got to have a baseline for what rents are and everything like that. And it's also an assist to, you know, producers, so forth, to get a baseline knowledge of what land is renting for, or at least somewhat of an independent source. And what we do is we take that information from that survey and we compile a report that's put into regions rather than counties. And a couple of things that helps with. Number one, you've got some counties that don't have a lot of data or observations. So what can wind up happening with that is you get a county, let's say there's just a couple of observations, just a handful, and it can really throw the average out of whack. If one tract, for instance, that's got a high productivity index sells for a lot, and or conversely, you know, you've only got four or five observations, let's say, and one sells, it's really low productivity land, looks like it drug the value down in that county or whatever. So putting it into these regions helps smooth some of that out. And then the other thing we do is we weight it by the amount of crop acres within each county and region, so that counties that have a lot of crop acres and a lot of observations have more weight in the valuation of the region, the average of the region, than those without. So we try to do some weighting. And to put that into perspective, imagine a tract of land sells, it's 40 acres, for instance, for $10,000 an acre. And then you got two other full sections that sell for, say, $5,000 an acre. Well, if you just take the average of each tract and you would say, you know, a section, and then 40 acres, and then take the average of those and divide by three, you'll get a way higher average than if you did it on a per acre basis, where you put it in a value per acre and divided by the total number of acres, if you know what I mean. So that's sort of what's done there. And then the region thing, we also, you know, has to do with like climate. For instance, the South Red River Valley is very different than the Northeast, which includes like Cavalier County, Ramsey County, Towner County, et cetera, to try to make help adjust for those climate differences in productivity.
Well, this year's survey, what'd you find out?
Oh, well, on the crop side, we statewide, we were up about 13.5%. For land values on crops. And then as last year, the same survey, we showed almost 11%, 11% increase last year, almost just short of that, 13.5% this year. On the rent side, last year we were up just over 3%. This year it was closer to 7% almost on rents for cropland statewide. And then on the pasture side, up 17.1% as a state on the value side, land values, and then on the rent side for pasture, up 7.1%. So pasture actually outpaced cropland as far as the gain. Obviously, cropland's more expensive. And, you know, I think part of that had to do with, well, a couple of things. When cropland tends to go up, it does tend to pull pasture land with it. But at the same time, when you have commodity prices as strong as they've been, which means to a cattle producer, high feed costs, you get a push, you get a lot of incentive for cow-calf guys to buy more pasture land and spend less on feed and more on grass. So when you have these high feed costs, it's not just cropland necessarily pulling up pasture land, but when commodity prices are high, that means high feed costs, which means folks looking for alternative, which means grass.
Sure. Was that kind of a surprise?
I was a bit surprised that pasture jumped as much as it did. I mean, not totally surprised in the sense that it went up, but 17% is a considerable jump. I mean, that's pretty big. I guess overall, the one thing I was surprised at a little bit was I kind of thought there would be a bigger jump in rents. I thought that from last year to this year, we would see rents up into the double digit range as far as the increase, and that did not happen. I think that probably part of that had to do with the fact that we kicked off last year with such high costs. If you'll recall, we had fertilizer prices over $1,000 a ton for urea. Equipment costs have continued to rise, et cetera, et cetera. Tenants were reluctant to lock into a big increase in cash rental negotiations, and landlords might have been reluctant to ask for it looking at where production costs were. But, you know, kind of spoiler alert, a preview, I don't think that's going to be as big a problem when we look at rents next year.
And I think, Brian, the other part of it that I've seen over the last 20, 25 years is it seems like growers are willing to pay more in buying land, but at least in, you know, eastern North Dakota, northwest Minnesota, they've been less aggressive on the cash rent side. So they're willing to pay a premium to buy it, but they haven't always been willing to, you know, pay a premium on the rent side unless you've got some aggressive operators that are looking at expanding.
Well, that's true. I mean, because at least, let's say, you know, for instance, you might have paid a little bit much for a purchase. Well, you still have the opportunity 10 years down the road, if land prices appreciate enough, that the purchase doesn't look, you know, so bad, or maybe even turns into a decent purchase if you get some capital appreciation. You don't get that with rents, right? You have to make the cash rent work in terms of cash flows in the years in which you do it. So folks are, like you said, going to be a lot less aggressive for the most part in engaging in high rental contracts, because those have to cash flow in the years in which they're negotiated.
One of the comments that I've made in the past as we visited about the study, and I think it's really great information. I've used it for baseline information to follow trends in the industry. And, you know, I think you've mentioned in the past too, Brian, that, you know, it's a guide to use. It's not a valuation for your farmland.
Absolutely right. I get a lot of questions, and many of them boil down to, tell me what my farmland is worth. And it doesn't really matter what survey you use, whether it's the ASFMRA one that gets put out in the spring or this one. They're not a substitute for an appraisal or for an expert going in, because as you know, being in this business, and everyone should know, every parcel is different. And when you do averages, you explain everything without explaining anything, I like to say. But what it is good for, what these are really good for, is benchmarking trends and looking at the direction that land is moving. Are rents going up? Are rents going down? Prices going up? Prices going down, et cetera. Where is the most costly land in the state? Where is the least costly? And to give you a baseline of where things stand. But as far as an actual valuing someone's farmland, these are not designed to be and should never be used in lieu of a good appraisal or something like that.
And just for fun, a couple of examples. Now that the land season has shifted back to more of a traditional fall till spring, you know, so in general, most of the land sales are wrapped up. It's not like we won't see any late spring or summer sales. But, you know, if we look at this past year in areas where we've hit records. I think likely the, at least publicly, the high water benchmark would be up by Hoople. There was 40 acres that sold in early December, and that was just a shade under 15,000 per tillable or 14,000 per deeded. You know, a parcel like that was the really every land broker's dream. It was 100% Glendon silt loam with a 92 PI. So what's important about Glendon is that it's both sugar beet and potato ground. And the other thing that I found, you know, a little bit crazy is that we even saw some land sales outside of the valley that were pushing, you know, $7,000-$8,000 an acre. So everything is just hot right now.
Yes. And that's true. And there, if you look at some of the stuff around the nation, I mean, just extremely high land prices in places like Iowa, et al, et cetera. And in other states, I mean, last year's surveys saw Kansas farmland increasing 24% and places like Minnesota closer to 20. But one of the things that we've been watching and we've kind of noted as economists is that if you recall the like programs like MFP1, MFP2, and CFAP, those were all paid out in cash. They were huge ad hoc programs that swamped even the old 2014 Farm Bill, which when that was written was the biggest program of all time, and CFAP far exceeded that. And then we're coming off of a couple of extremely strong net farm income years in 21 and 22. And so you've got this, then finally we've had, you know, record low interest rates up until last year helping facilitate it as well. But even if they weren't record low, with all the cash that was accumulated during the years prior, there was just this big push and pent up demand for farmland purchases. And essentially for the last year and a half or so, we've just kind of seen the lid come off and that pent up demand, those folks are going out and making the purchases.
Is that basically on that record farm income that we saw the last couple of years?
I think part of it is, but I brought up the cash comment before, because we had a lot of producers sitting on a lot of cash from those MFP programs as well as CFAP. And then you had, well, I'm, you know, working through the North Dakota data, but a new record in net farm income for 22. And all of a sudden, you got folks sitting on a lot of cash, and oftentimes when producers are sitting on cash, they tend to turn it into a land purchase. And that's what we're seeing happen. It's not surprising at all that's what's transpired. What's going to be interesting going forward is if and when there is a cooling off period. And I think that Kansas, the Kansas City Federal Reserve, I should say, does a pretty good job of tracking the volume of sales in their district. And they have seen fewer and fewer transactions coming down the pike in their surveys with lenders. Still quite a bit of purchasing activity going on, but it's slowed down to a degree, which maybe signifies that there's not that there's less appetite, but that a lot of the cash has been spent and that was out there, that folks have, you know, went ahead and made their big acquisition. And it may be slowing down a little bit, but that remains to be seen if that holds.
The other comment with cash is, in a lot of cases, the other item that folks like to spend, or farmers like to spend money on, is iron, right? And yes, that's been in pretty tight supply, you know. So I think that has probably helped in adding to some of these cash positions when you can't get equipment for a couple years out.
Oh yeah, that's absolutely true. Not only have the equipment costs gone up and continue to increase, but that's assuming you can even take delivery of it. You know, I talked to some folks who made some purchases back in September and October and were informed that they had to pay now and would take delivery in June. And so you're probably right that there's a situation where they're putting off trades, trading off equipment, not because the funds aren't available, but because the equipment isn't available at this point in time. So you're either trading off for a piece of used equipment, or you just hold on to what you got for another year and see if you can make it work. and wait until some of this supply is available so that you can at least take possession on around the time you purchase it.
Well, we've come off those couple of record years of income. Any preliminary numbers looking for 2023?
Well, the best we have right now is sort of the USDA's projection for 2023, and it's projected to be lower than 2022, which isn't a surprise. I mean, 2022's maybe going to, they don't have the final information on 2022 yet. Nobody does, because the marketing year isn't completely concluded, but perhaps a record. And that's kind of the way it's trending. So for us to say that 2023 is going to be lower than that isn't necessarily a surprise if we're coming off record highs, but it is considerably, it is projected to be considerably lower. And the biggest reason for that is prices have come down in most of our major commodity categories. But not so low that we're looking at one of these 2017 kind of years or anything like that. Just when you're coming off 2 years as strong as we have had, it shouldn't be a surprise that 23, that we're going to return down to a net farm income trend that's closer to what we'd seen the last 5-6 years before some of the program, the ad hoc programs notwithstanding.
On a national level, one of the latest pieces of data that I found from USDA was that we're looking at inflation adjusted, that last year would be the largest net farm income since 1973, which just seems crazy. What are you seeing for the data that you work on, Brian? What are you seeing for preliminary numbers for the 2022 crop year on the North Dakota level?
On the North Dakota level, we're looking strong. In fact, looking at the valley and the non-valley, I just did a calculation. I don't know if the listeners know or whatever, but we put together those farm business management record books in conjunction with the adult farm management education program in North Dakota. And I did an inflation adjusted look, and prior to the year that you just described, or not prior to, but since then, the next best year was 2012 in North Dakota that folks know well. And that net farm income was around $325,000 or so. And inflation adjusted for 2022, to put it on par with 2012, it's looking to be closer. If we were doing it in 2012 dollars, it'd be $350,000. So $25,000 higher than 2012. So a little bit higher than the best since the 1970s. And that overall number right now is right around $450,000 in 2022 dollars. Okay, so I try to adjust for inflation to make it as apples to apples as possible. Long story short, 2021 and 2022 are both projected to have been better than 2012, even adjusting for inflation. So that in itself helps kind of explain what we've seen with land values over the last year or so, going up at the rate at which they have. And that's also, again, why I'm a bit surprised that rents haven't come up any more than they have with those kind of net income numbers. But at the same time, rents may wind up lagging, in a sense, what land values have done, and may catch up in subsequent years.
So twice a year I write a newsletter. The next one's coming up around Memorial Day, and I kind of wait until I've got your information, Brian, or your study that you work with, and then Minneapolis Fed puts out some data in May. The second newsletter I write is typically in October, maybe mail it out before Thanksgiving. So when I was looking at the USDA data back in October, at that time, on a national level, we were trending to be the second high, or the highest since 2012. And then when I looked in January, we just blew through those numbers. So, it's kind of crazy just in a few months like that, how the numbers kind of went haywire in a good way, so to speak.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's incredible. There was a time where I tracked these USDA projections and would show like the February versus the fall for it, because the USDA comes out with these net farm income projections twice a year. And when you looked at last year in January, 2022 was projected to be considerably below 2021, right? Because we were looking at these high production costs. Then when the fall one came out, 2022 was projected to be around maybe 2021. Then when the February one came out, like you said, it just blew past 2012, 2021, everything else. And so here we sit at 23, looking below those few. But I just find it interesting that that's happened. And I guess it boils down to last year's numbers. We had high production costs, but we had strong yields, at least in North Dakota, for sure in North Dakota. I wouldn't say records by any stretch, but strong enough.
Yeah,
but you had a full year though to market your crop, whether it was old crop or new crop, and it really didn't matter when to get a solid price last year. And that's a lot of that's the difference between 22 and 21. 21 also we had a weaker yield year, but that's kind of the story that transpired through those years.
So in recent months, I've been telling folks there's, you know, I'm not too sure when this land market, if we peaked out, if we've started to plateau. I mean, that's something for hindsight, right? But what I've been telling people is that there's a couple of warning signs out there, maybe some red flags that are popping up. One, as we talk about the net farm income side, it's not going to take much to turn this thing on its side a little bit with, you know, given the input costs and just some corrections in commodity prices. You know, the other one would be interest rates. You know, I felt pretty comfortable through the spring season that values would hold. You know, but it seems like at some point in time when, you know, and you made the comparison down or the comment about Kansas, you know, at some point in time, once this cash position starts getting depleted, I think interest rates are going to catch up with land values. So, you know, what's your take, Brian?
Sure. First of all, on the input cost side, I just want to make a comment on that. We had high input costs when we had the big net farm incomes from about 07 to 2012. They just kept continuing up and up along with land prices. And input costs, even first commodity prices are eventually going to come down. They always do. That's not a doom and gloom projection, or I'm not some kind of future, you know, I can't tell the future, but what I can do is go back and look at what's happened in ag over 100 years, and it's cyclical. It always has been, and my guess is it will continue. But what happens is production costs tend to be sticky, and when commodity prices do come down, and I fully expect that they will, the production costs are going to lag that by a few years. And so once we see these commodity prices come down, we're going to be paying these high input costs for a few years afterwards. That's probably going to eat into a lot of this net farm income. That's the first thing. Now, with respect to interest rates, and I'm putting out a newsletter edition kind of commenting on this that our department puts out monthly, should be coming out in the next week or so. But interest rates are real. Obviously, they're not as much of a factor when folks are paying cash, but at the same time, they also kind of are when you think about it in terms of like rates of return with comparable investment ideas. And when I did the most recent math for the increase in land prices that just happened versus the increase in rents, not accounting for property taxes, so I don't reduce that, the capitalization rate I came up with was right around 2.7%. 2.7, 2.75. And it's been around, using that same math, since about 2018, 2017, that 2.75 to 3% range for quite a while. Well, at the same time, interest rates were around 3.25, 3.5. And if you go all the way back to like 1989, which is as far back as I've taken the data, because things kind of got screwy in the 80s, as far as this goes, but that cap rate on farmland is typically about 100 basis points below the 30-year prime mortgage rate. Okay, so if the prime mortgage rate is 10%, then that cap rate would be about 9%, which it was in 1989. And as interest rates have come down since then, that cap rate has maintained that relationship till we got to the point where prevailing interest rate was about 3.25, 3.5, and that cap rate was 2.75 and hung out there for a while. Well, now the interest rate is about 6.1, 6.2%, depending on which site you look at or which statistic you use. And that cap rate's 2.75. And so if you believe that that relationship is strong and that it's going to hold, and we see the erosion of cash and folks have to maybe start borrowing money to make purchases, how interested are buyers going to be to purchase land if they have to borrow the money at 6%, seeing a cap rate or a cash rent versus market value of farmland at 2.75 and 3%? If the relationship is as strong as it had been in the past, that rent needs to increase to about 5% rather than 2.75 or so, or 5.2. And according to my math, that would take, if farmland prices didn't increase at all, they didn't change, that would take about 7 years at rents above 10% per year appreciation to catch it.
Yeah, we had, so, back in the fall, we had a couple of appraisers on, and, you know, in calculating the real estate taxes and then kind of their standard is a 5% management fee, you know, they were seeing the rate at about 1.75 to 2.25, which would make sense with your calculations, you know, Brian, just a different way of looking at it. But it certainly shows how things are maybe a little bit out of whack in the short term.
Yeah, and I've seen it done the way you just described it. For me, it doesn't matter as long as you're upfront with how you're calculating it and consistent, because it's more informative than it is, you know, the hard and fast rule. As long as we know, kind of like the rate of unemployment, there's four or five different ways to calculate it. But as long as we all know what we're talking about, it's not an issue. But yes, that's kind of the key with it and what I've been looking at. So I guess my position on that is that's why I've been kind of looking at this thinking, are cash rents going to start increasing? And I think that has to do with mostly how long do interest rates stay at this level? And the truth is, I do a lot of presentations on interest rates and the Fed and what's going on. And the average federal funds rate going back to the 1950s is about 4.7%. Right now, we're at about 5. So we're really not that high in a historical standard, but we are very high when you compare it to the last decade or so. And, you know, the prevailing mortgage rate average, I know the 80s were a little bit high for quite a long time, but then we had the last 10 years where they were low. But that average is close, you know, between 7.5% and 8%. So really, on a historical timeline, 6.25 is not high by any historical metric of interest rates being. So I guess the question I have to ask myself when I'm trying to think about where we're headed down the road, how long do I believe rates are going to stay at 6.25% for the mortgage rate or so? And are they going to go up or down in answering that question? Because I believe the relationship is real. I believe that it, because of reasons we've already discussed on borrowing versus the rate of return. And so if that's true, then you're going to have to see an acceleration of cash rents, because I don't think we're going to see land values come down. I don't see that coming in the future. But we could get kind of like we got from 2014 to 2020, where they don't move upwards for 6-7 years and rents continue to inch up, but kind of jump upwards at 10% per year to catch it. Because you get to asking yourself, if I make a purchase, this is the rate of return I got to have to justify the interest rate I'm paying.
How about inflation, Brian? Oh, yeah.
Well, the numbers that came out from March suggest, it's one data point, but they come out monthly, so you know we tend to read as much as we can into single data points that are spaced out that far. But it looks like, at least right now, that inflation is at least slowing down, which is good. And so there's two things going on, though. And one of them is the labor market. Okay, so when the Fed is making their decisions, one of the metrics they look at pretty heavily is not just consumer prices, but the labor market. And the labor market has been very tight for the last couple of years, which is a new situation, really, because one of the things the Fed, they're not necessarily, I hate to say they're trying to do it, but in a way they are. is to increase the rate of unemployment. Okay, because as you increase rates, businesses grow more slowly. Some businesses are forced to lay off. If people are unemployed or worried about being unemployed, they don't spend money. They're not spending money. Prices, you know, ease up a bit, and folks aren't out there purchasing. So they've increased the rates, but yet this labor market, even though there's been a slowdown in hiring, unemployment's only at about 3.5%. I mean, that's still a historically low number, and we all have anecdotal evidence in and around the Fargo and North Dakota area of businesses having trouble finding employees. So the layoffs just aren't happening. Folks really aren't worried about being laid off so much, especially nationwide. And so inflation contends is being kind of persistent despite the rate hikes. And so the Fed keeps hiking rates to try to bring it down, but unemployment number continues to hang out there. Which hasn't been historically the case. As they've hiked rates, you see unemployment go up. And so the slowdown is important. The deceleration, I should say, in inflation is important because it means that maybe we won't see the 0.75% rate hikes that we saw last year coming month after month after month. But it does mean, though, I think with the employment numbers and the fact that inflation is still at 5% or above, the Fed's targeting 2%, and I think that they're going to want to continue to send the message that, hey, we're going to keep fighting inflation until it's under control. And so I think the rate hikes are going to continue until we see that happen, because they've got to convince everyone that this is just going to continue until the inflation rate comes down. And therefore, right now the market, the majority, at least last I checked, is baking in about 0.25 rate hike at the next meeting, which would increase it, you know, another 25 basis points. And I think that's probably likely to happen. And then it's more wait and see, with what's going on, because right now core inflation is still well above 5%, which excludes food and energy from the equation. And I think they're going to want to continue working on it until they see it down closer to that 2% level. So I think we're going to see a few more rate hikes. I do think inflation is going to be under control, hopefully by the end of the year. But the Fed's going to have to continue taking the actions that they've taken in order to make it happen. And the final thing I'll say on that, I've had some questions about, well, what about the bank failures that have occurred so far and concerns with that? Those bank failures are very different than what occurred in the financial crisis, because those were, you know, venture capital, tech heavy banks that were invested in very specific segments of the market or had dealings with very specific segments of the market. And as a result, it sent some shockwaves in terms of folks' perception, but in terms of the financial system in general, it didn't really have the reverberations that like the mortgage crisis had, where it basically the tentacles were in just about everything back in 08, you know, that period.
Brian, we've talked about a couple of studies. Can you maybe provide a website where folks can find these studies, and then any closing comments from you?
Well, the studies that we put out are best found with a simple search engine on the internet anymore. You can just put in North Dakota land values, put in North Dakota cropland 2023, North Dakota pasture land 2023, and those news releases should come forward. If you want to look at the trust lands information, you can search North Dakota Department of Trust Lands land survey, and it should be one of the first items that pop up there that you can take a look at to look at this information. But again, I guess my final thought on a lot of what's gone on is ag tends to be cyclical. There's a lot of things going on right now. When 2013 happened, we were coming off of 2010 to 13. Everyone thought, or not everyone, but several people thought that $8 corn and $14 beans were here to stay. Then we promptly dropped to $4 and under corn and beans below $8. That happened later on. Thinking that that can't happen again, you're kind of ignoring the cyclical nature of ag. So I encourage producers to take advantage of what's transpired, pay down some debt where you can, and make sure that we're not eating too much into that working capital with new purchases of equipment and land, and we're set up for the 3 or 4 years that'll probably happen down the road where things might get tighter.
Thanks to Brian Parman for being part of this conversation. The Well-Grounded Podcast is a presentation of Acres and Shares and the Red River Farm Network. If you have farmland or beetstock questions, please call me at 218-779-1293.
And you can also find this podcast on iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. It's also available at rrfn.com and acresandshares.com. Until next time, I'm Randy Conan.
And I'm Jason Menke.